Thanks very much, Tim. Thanks very much to the committee for asking me. It's nice to have be standing here with that image of Sidgwick just about 10, 20 metres away from me. And particularly pleasant, I think, to have his beard, rather magnificent beard, in such plain sight. Left to myself, I have this tendency to turn my public talks entirely into recitations of amusing Sidgwick anecdotes. I'll try to restrict myself to just one, specifically about that beard. As it happened, I was looking through some of Sidgwick's unpublished letters, and there was one that he wrote in his sort of mid-late 20s, roughly my age now. And it's a letter to his sister, and it's about him walking in the court of Trinity College, where he was a young fellow, and seeing a very eminent theologian walk in. And Sidgwick, who was at this point, we know from pictures we have of him, was entirely clean-shaven. And the reason he was entirely clean-shaven is that despite his most sincere efforts, he was unable to grow a beard. He writes to his sister saying, "My dear Binnie, it's the most splendid beard I've ever seen in my life. Do you think, my dear sister, that I shall ever be able to have one as magnificent?" And I'm glad that I'm now in a position to be able to say, yes, he was, so there's hope for us all. I say this in part as a kind of preemptive apology to Sidgwick. And the few things I'm going to say about him specifically are going to be largely critical, but I hope it will be clear just how high a regard I hold him in. A couple more words about the context in which some of the thoughts that led to this paper, and more generally my doctoral thesis, for which some of this is drawn, came about. Now, Plato famously says that philosophy begins in wonder, and that's true for some of us. I did once speak to an eminent Leibniz scholar who told me that what got him into philosophy was waking up every morning and saying to himself, "Being. What's that all about?" I must confess that I'm not sufficiently profound to have ever woken up with that on my mind. Of course, wonder of this sort isn't the only thing that propels people into philosophy. There's simple curiosity, there's indignation, anger, desire to do something about real-world injustices, and perhaps a thought that philosophy could perhaps help us to think more clearly about, maybe do something about it. Those injustices. Well, I must confess, my own motivations, at least at the start, aren't even as noble as that. The honest description of my motivation for thinking about common sense morality was simple annoyance. And the annoyance was directed at what I took to be a distortion of what ordinary moral thought and practice looked like when one encountered that ordinary moral thought and practice described in the works of philosophers. Well, I'll explain in a little bit more detail what I mean there. Now, the notion of common sense morality belongs, I think, to this set of notions that we find in different branches of philosophy. As I put it early on in my handout, every branch of philosophy needs its country cousin. There's a phrase we use in the philosophy of mind, a contrast that's often drawn between theoretical views in the philosophy of mind and folk psychology in the other. And I'm going to return to that analogy in a second. We sometimes hear people speaking of naive metaphysics. An old tutor of mine used to call it peasant metaphysics. Thank goodness that isn't standard in terminology of discipline. And there is in ethics the phrase we sometimes use, common sense morality. And I take these notions roughly to be expressing the same kind of contrast between the theoretical, post-philosophical, refined, sophisticated, etc. on the one hand, and the folk, the naive. Sidgwick, unfortunately, sometimes uses the word vulgar as a way to describe the other side of this contrast. Now, I'm specifically interested in morality, and this thing is sometimes called common sense morality, but I suspect some of the things I want to say might well have implications or resonances to people working in these other disciplines who use this terminology or relied on it for some of the things they wanted to say. And roughly, here's what these other notions are doing. In quite a lot of philosophy, we find one kind of, I'll call it a conservative strand, which consists in a conception of philosophy as an attempt to vindicate, defend this pre-theoretical common sense, folk notions, etc. There's other radical, revisionary, reformist, etc. set of conceptions which involve leaving that behind, using it as a target for critique, dismissing it as being naive, unsophisticated, confused, reactionary. And these are all words that pop up constantly, this kind of back and forth between what exactly is the relationship between what philosophers say and the thing that non-philosophers say about the same kind of subject matter? And you might well think, well, it's not clear how seriously these things should be taken, something like metaphysics, what do they know? It's a notion you sometimes hear from people who have a certain view about what kind of expertise philosophy might give you, if any. In ethics, on the other hand, it does seem that there's quite a bit more at stake in the gap that often arises between the kinds of things philosophers say about ethics and the kinds of things non-philosophers say, think, feel, etc. But the first thing I want to do is draw a rough kind of distinction, which is more or less based on a parallel distinction that's often made in the philosophy of mind. And this is between two ways of thinking about folk psychology. There's one way in which the phrase is sometimes used, where it basically refers to a kind of a set of capacities or abilities, usually to do with the capacity to explain, predict behavior. And this is often called the mind-reading conception. On the other hand, there's this other way in which the phrase folk psychology is sometimes used. You'll often find it in David Lewis's work on the subject, for instance, where it's about a set of platitudes that ordinary people are inclined to endorse about the mind or about psychology. Now, I would say that something roughly along these lines can probably be applied to the moral case as well. We can speak of common sense morality, similarly, as either being like the first sense of the mind-reading sense of folk psychology, a set of capacities or abilities that are best observed in practice. That's a way, it's something that people have that allows them to do a certain set of things. And on the other hand, there's this other way of thinking about folk psychology, I'm sorry, about common sense morality, that I'm going to call the doxastic conception, which treats it as a body of propositions, a network of propositions which, if affirmed or avowed by some particular person, is a body of beliefs, hence my phrase, the doxastic conception. So these two things, the dispositional on the one hand and the doxastic, one of the questions I want to raise is, how do we understand the relationship between these two ways in which we might legitimately think about common sense morality? Now, one other point that kind of makes it clear why I'm interested in this. I take it to be relatively uncontroversial that common sense morality is methodologically, at least, indispensable to a great deal of contemporary moral philosophy. Common sense morality is often used to provide a set of starting points for theorizing. By starting points here, I mean something like epistemic or methodological starting points. It's just what you work from. And I'm not saying that common sense acts as some kind of basic set of theoretical foundations for ethical theories, which is probably not true for most contemporary ethical theories. And a simple way of putting that thought is to say, if someone asks you, where should you start in philosophy? It's a very simple answer you can give to that, which is you start where you start with anything. You start from where you are. And that way of putting it makes it sound inescapable, and there's a sense in which it is inescapable. Of course you start from where you are. Where else could you possibly start? Now, all the interesting philosophical questions and difficulties arise in trying to make some sense of what this metaphor means non-metaphorically. How do you to express more exactly what someone is saying when they say, well, we've got to start from where we are? One question we can ask about here is, who's the we? Big, very important question. Is it people of some very narrowly conceived community? Is it people with tenured chairs in philosophy? Is we meant to be people who speak English? Is it meant to be the human race? Is it meant to be all rational beings? And there are variations in exactly what the extension of the pronoun is taken to be in much of this philosophy. Another question we could well ask is, what does it mean to say we start from where we are? What exactly does it mean to say that theorizing begins somewhere, in some place? What's the metaphor of place doing in this context? There's another question we can ask, which is, I mean, this idea of we start from a certain place, but to go where exactly? And what's the destination? And perhaps another question some people might ask, which is, why leave? Just stay where you are and be happy there. Right? So where does the Wanderlust come from? What's this desire to go off to other places? And part of what I did in when I was writing my doctoral thesis was to develop, perhaps too great length, the force of this geographical or cartographical analogy, this idea of philosophy as a kind of journey, and what's involved in catching out or making more explicit what's involved in the various elements of this this metaphor or conceit about the purpose of philosophy. For the moment, I'm only really interested in the second of the questions I mentioned, which is this question of where are we? One simple answer that I'm going to give to this is common sense. That's where we are. Or if you like, this is whether meant to be a kind of trivial stipulation. The phrase common sense is often used just to mean a description of where we are before we start actually sort of thinking really hard about philosophical questions. There's this kind of set of starting points we have, and that set of starting points, which we can leave behind, sometimes retain something of, do something or the other with, but the idea is that's nevertheless where we start. And this is my first most minimal characterization of what the notion of common sense, or folk, etc., does in many of these connections. It's the idea that it provides for a set of starting points. Now, I've said something about a doxastic versus a dispositional conception. One of the things I want to do is to speak up for a certain way of thinking about common sense, which is going to be in support of what I've called the dispositional conception over the doxastic. But I want to be clear right at the start that it isn't meant to be playing off these views against each other. I think there's a place for both, and they aren't necessarily contradictory in any way. You can adopt both of these pictures. Common sense as a bunch of skills, dispositions, common sense as a set of beliefs. The question is rather, methodologically speaking, what's the more fruitful way of doing ethics? In what way do we conceive of the starting points for ethics that are going to produce the most interesting philosophical work? Right, that's my minimal description of what I'm trying to say here. Now, I've said a lot about the doxastic conception to make it a little bit clearer what I have in mind when I say that, and that's quotation number one on your handouts. I quote it, it's a line from W.D. Sir David Ross's lectures on the foundations of ethics, given in 1935. I don't think Ross is terribly interested in his own writings, rather that I've never seen a clearer statement of the position that I'm trying to distance myself from and present an alternative to. Let me sort of read out some of the crucial bits of that. So here's how Ross more or less starts his lectures. He says, "I propose to take as my starting point the existence of what is commonly called the moral consciousness. And by this I mean the existence of a large body of beliefs and convictions, NB, to the effect that there are certain kinds of acts that ought to be done and certain kinds of things that ought to be brought into existence. Our object must be to compare them with each other and to study them in themselves with a view to seeing which best survive such examination and which must be rejected, either because in themselves they are ill-grounded or because they contradict other convictions that are better grounded, and to clear up, so far as we can, ambiguities that lurk in them." You note the underlined bit at the start, the way in which he goes straight from the ordinary moral consciousness and more or less stipulates a definition of it, or his definition of it, as being a body of beliefs and convictions. So this is an example of what I take to be doxastic in that conception of common sense morality, which, as you'll see, I'm treating as more or less synonymous with or functionally equivalent to the ordinary moral consciousness that Ross speaks of. So the idea is something like this. Why take beliefs? Why might Ross have thought it's a good place to start with beliefs and convictions about these things? Well, here's a simple answer. What do you want to end up with? The answer is a theory, right? A philosophical theory of morality. And the theory itself is meant to be a set of propositions. What else could a theory be? Then presumably you want to end up with a brick house, so you start with some bricks. You want to end up with something that's going to have ultimately a propositional doxastic structure, and you start with things that have a propositional doxastic form. That's how you're going to get something that's made out of the same sorts of things. Obviously, you throw out some bricks if they're not the right sort or the right shape, etc. But the idea is you start with bricks, end with bricks, start with beliefs, end with a purified, refined, etc. set of beliefs. So that's what I take to be the motivation behind adopting this way of thinking about common sense. Note also that what Ross says in the second half of that quotation, that's something that Sidgwick, for one, also says in a number of places. This idea that this isn't some sort of weird new conception of moral philosophy that we, Ross, Sidgwick, etc., have come up with. This is just how it's always been done. So I've given a few more quotations which give us a sense of the way in which these philosophers construe the philosophical tradition that's come before them. So this is the second half of the first quotation from Ross. "This," he says, "is the time-honoured method of ethics. It was the method of Socrates and of Plato, it was the method of Aristotle, and has indeed nowhere been better formulated than it is by him. Kant's method was the same." So that's Ross. And then you'll see something Sidgwick says, and this is something he dictates to an amanuensis right before he dies, actually. So he's giving a sense of his intellectual autobiography and explains the moment when he had this epiphany. He saw that everyone really has been doing basically the same thing, which also happens to be conveniently what Sidgwick had been doing. He says, what he, Aristotle, gave us in the Nicomachean Ethics was the common sense morality of Greece, reduced to consistency by careful comparison, given not as something external to him, but as what we, he and others, think, ascertained by reflection. And was this not really the Socratic induction, elicited by interrogation? Might I not imitate this, do the same for our morality, here and now, in the same manner of impartial reflection on current opinion? So again, note the doxastic vocabulary. It's about what we think, not what we feel, for instance. Not what we do, but what we think. How do you get at it? Answer by reflection. And I think roughly it means something like introspection. You kind of sit down in an armchair, ideally, and you think for a bit, and then you get the contents of common sense. And finally, the last two phrases. Common sense is treated as a body of current opinion. So Aristotle did it for his contemporaries in ancient Greece. I'm going to do it for my contemporaries in Cambridge, circa 1874. Perfectly reasonable conclusion, essentially. And you note that Rawls, who of course is heavily influenced by the situation in a number of ways, in the first edition of The Theory of Justice, says something along these lines. Moral philosophy is Socratic. We may want to change our present considered judgments once their regulated principles are brought to light. And there is, as you will doubtless be aware, a very powerful idea of ethical method we find in Rawls, something he labels reflective equilibrium. The one way in which you can see of it is another way of thinking about what's involved in reflecting on common sense as interpreted as a body of beliefs. You think about various commitments, express them in a propositional form, and then do some stuff with it. Tease out contradictions, ambiguities lurking within or among those propositions, and then try and find an alternative to them. It's based in some measure on those propositions you started up with, but will leave at least some of them behind. It's noteworthy, I think, that all of these people, at one point or the other, seem to trace this genealogy back to the first figure in the canon, that's Socrates. They're saying, look, this is the tradition we're part of. We're part of the Socratic tradition, perhaps of philosophy more generally, certainly of moral philosophy. And the way they all interpret Socrates is as someone who went around reflecting on people's beliefs, teasing out contradictions among them, and then sort of trying to come up with something better. And so powerful, I think, is the kind of view that these people have given us, and that we've inherited in the way we today do moral philosophy, that this is what we see, just like they did in Socrates as well. Now, I'll come back to Socrates in a second. I'm going to propose in the second half of this paper that it was a mistake on their part to see Socrates as doing what they took him to be doing. It actually means something else. But I'll put him aside for just 1 second, just to give you a better sense of what I take philosophically rather than historically and exegetically to be at stake here. Now, Ross, that first quotation, I'm taking to be a paradigm case of this doxastic interpretation of common sense morality. Common sense morality is constituted by some set of beliefs, convictions, or perhaps more modestly, the part of common sense morality that's most germane to the activities of ethical theorists is its propositional doxastic part. There might be all this other stuff lurking around there, but we can't do much with feelings and stuff. We can do stuff with beliefs. Yeah, they're propositions, they're exactly the kinds of things philosophers can work with. Now, just as a passing remark, it's interesting that Hume is one of the canonical moral philosophers left out of Ross's list. And it's worth reflecting on why. And Simon Blackburn isn't here, so no, he isn't. It's one of the things that Blackburn, many of his writings, points out. There's a long tradition, I mean, pretty much up to Blackburn, of telling the story of the history of moral philosophy that leaves out a Humean approach. So I'll just mention that in passing. But note that Ross's point isn't meta-ethical. It's got nothing to do with cognitivism versus non-cognitivism, belief versus denial, or any of that stuff. I mean, what he's saying here is a methodological point. Philosophy, insofar as it's interested in things like truth, falsity, consistency, inconsistency, ambiguity, charity, precision, I mean, where you can apply some of these tests, some of these rational tests, is once you've got a body of propositions to be working with. Right? I can't tell you whether your feelings are true or false. It's just the wrong sort of thing to apply tests of truth. But quite different once you've managed to tease out from our ordinary practice, feelings, etc., some set of propositions that philosophers can work with. Now, there's a bunch of really familiar philosophical questions lurking in the vicinity here. When I speak of contrasting propositional, doxastic on the one hand, and dispositional on the other, there's a general question about the metaphysics of dispositions. To what extent, if any, can you give an account of dispositions that captures the nature of that disposition in some kind of counterfactual statement? Or are there things such as dispositional essences? There's vast metaphysical literature on this kind of question about the nature of dispositions, reductivism about them, and so forth. I'm not really taking a position on that. I don't dare. I tried reading recent papers and analysis of these questions, and I found that pretty much everything that literature has left me behind. So just out of prudence, I'm starting not to take any view on that. There's this other related but slightly distinct question about, more generally, for any set of behavioural dispositions, there's a question of how far and to what extent in practice and in principle it's possible to give a propositional account of what goes into having that principle. So yeah, if you play tennis and a certain set of dispositions that involves, could there ever be some finite list of propositions in which that skill could be expressed? And the answer, I'm trying to say that even if it's in principle possible that you could come up with such a list, it's going to be pretty difficult in practice. So for any skill that we have, it's always going to be difficult to come up with any finite-sized body of propositions that fully gives us an account of what it is to have that skill. There's far too much in the way of judgment, improvisation, resourcefulness, etc. That's in the nature of having any skill. And it's really hard to kind of reduce it to some set of proposition. So that I take to be a pretty banal point. But I'm going to put some weight on this last banal point simply because it's so uncontroversial. Now, here's one set of examples of philosophers going straight to the doxastic or propositional part of common sense. Think of the way in which thought experiments or examples tend to be used in a lot of moral philosophy. Thought experiments are often, as you're probably aware, called intuition pumps. And the idea of an intuition here is roughly, among whatever else it is a kind of belief. So you tell the story about walking past a child drowning in a shallow pond, or past a railway station with nicely arranged combinations of workers on one or the other track and a conveniently located lever and so forth, or standing on a footbridge and working out whether to push someone off it. Now, in each of these cases, what we're asked to do is to say, what do you believe one ought to be? I take it that's roughly the question that's being asked. And often, not always, but often, there's a pretty restricted palette available to us in the way in which we can express the judgments we make in these imaginary situations. So the question often tends to be, would it be wrong to push someone off a bridge to stop a train that would otherwise kill 5 people? So there are some things that you might want to say in this kind of context. For instance, I suppose I ought, but I wouldn't, but I don't know why, or I wouldn't do it, and probably shouldn't do it, but I feel really uncomfortable about saying that. Or, I do it, and I think we ought to do it, but I feel really guilty about it afterwards. And here are some of the things we do, in fact, want to say faced with these examples. And part of what it is to spend a certain number of years doing philosophy is often say, no, I'm not asking about all of that. I just want you to say, is it wrong? Is it obligatory? Is it forbidden? Etc. And fair enough, right? If you're trying to come up with a theory whose ultimate structure is going to be what's forbidden, what's obligatory, what's permissible, what's required, what's your prerogatory, and so forth, then of course you're going to look in common sense morality for judgments which have that kind of structure. But the worry, my worry here, and this is genuinely a worry, I'm not using worry as a kind of polite euphemism for objection, it's something I'm genuinely worried about, what are we losing of ourselves? Are we actually turning ourselves into less interesting human beings by restricting the kinds of thoughts and feelings we have to whatever it is that the current trends in analytic philosophy allow us to say in our academic, disciplinary, formal discourse? So, nothing I'm going to say now is a way of dismissing the value of doing this kind of emphasis on clarity, precision, wonderful things. Thank you, Cedric, for bequeathing that kind of approach to philosophy. All of the virtues of analytic philosophy as it's currently practiced have to do with the fact that we insist on some of these things. But hang on there, let's make sure that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's make sure that our insistence on precision isn't really a way of avoiding a complexity that's really there in the subject matter. One brief account of what it is that I think to be missing from this sort of set of approaches is moral psychology, the elements of psychology that don't allow themselves readily to be expressed as propositions. And one thing I'm going to do in the second half of my paper is to try and give give a hint as to what kind of philosophy could be that could avoid this kind of reductiveness or this kind of closing down of our perceptiveness to phenomena that are genuinely there. Now, I know that it can often be rather annoying to listen to these sort of manifesto-like pronouncements. If you think there's this other way of doing philosophy, then why don't you just do it and show us its virtues? And at some point, given enough time and money and secure fellowships, I hope to do so. One thing, and I'd be perfectly willing to accept that this is, I think, was it Stephen Yarblow who writes a paper called, was something like an outline of an advertisement of a sketch towards a putative prolegomenon or something in causation. I'm afraid some of this is going to have some of that kind of feature. But one way in which I'm going to try and do it is to return to that historical point I put aside at the start. And that's this question about, is what Socrates was doing the same thing what Sidgwick was doing, what Ross is doing, what Rawls is doing? Or can we just start from this kind of self-conception these philosophers have of their standing in this long Socratic tradition and then say, well, hang on a second, let's actually look to what Socrates does. Not Rawls' Socrates, not Sidgwick's Socrates, but Plato's Socrates, our most extensive source of what the historical Socrates might have been like. And then look to ask ourselves to what extent the contemporary practice of moral philosophy looks like that. And if it turns out that Socrates was doing something different from what we're doing, then at the very least, we could probably stop making the kind of claim Rawls makes, which is we're basically doing what Socrates did because we're not. Okay, so here's what I want to say about Socrates. This is, I'm now in part two, by the way, of the handout at this point. There's a common way of thinking about what Socrates was doing when he conducted his well-earned conversations with ordinary Athenians, and there's a rough kind of paradigm. Obviously, he does slightly different things in each dialogue, and it's not always clear that there's such a thing as the Socratic method. But there's a bunch of recognisable patterns, similarities in the things Socrates does in different dialogues. And so I've set it out, and this is, should be at the top of page 3 of your handouts. You get someone to define some ethical term, courage, temperance, justice, beauty, whatever. And then he says, well, here are some other questions about courage, justice, beauty, whatever. There, you've just contradicted yourself. Right? And he says, oh, right, Socrates, I see that I've just contradicted myself, so I clearly have to withdraw one of the things I said because inconsistency is really, really bad. I'll probably just give up my definition. But very occasionally, they keep the definition and abandon one of their other assertions or claims. And repeat this process several times until something gives. And someone says, well, actually, Socrates, I've got to be getting on somewhere. And quite understandably, at least, I mean, one advantage of the supervision of tutorial system now is that at least has to end on the hours. Imagine Socrates given just infinite amount of time to deal with a Cambridge undergraduate. Right, so here's one. Here's the connection between Socratic practice and this examination of common sense morality. I take it that what's one of the things that's interesting about what Socrates is doing here isn't the fact that here's one man, Socrates, talking to this one other, usually man, Glaco or Meno or Charmides or whoever. It's not about them specifically, or it's not only about that specific interlocutor. It's rather that these people who get into these conversations with Socrates are, to some degree and in some imperfect way, giving voice to something that goes beyond them, some wider set of practices, dispositions, maybe even beliefs. And so in showing they're inconsistent, at least some of the time, you might very well be engaging in what we today call social or cultural critique. It's not merely that you, Glaucon, have contradicted yourself, it's rather that, insofar, Glaucon, as you've done your best to give expression to this broadly shared set of beliefs, practices, etc., your inability to give a consistent account of them says something about those dispositions themselves, says something about those practices themselves. This is not always going to be true, obviously. Sometimes it's just going to be that they're very inarticulate or stupid or something else and don't do their best to express the complexity of ordinary moral thought and practice. But that's, I take it, what gives Socrates' method its value, and it's part of what put people off him. It's very possibly what got him executed, this idea that he's very uncomfortably calling attention to ambiguities and tensions within practice that go beyond the particular people to whom he's speaking these dialogues. Now, I've been very careful in what I've said so far to speak of Socrates as interested in these people's practices, behaviour, dispositions, feelings, character. And I'm very happy to add, as one element on that list, their beliefs. Right? Because clearly one of the things they're saying, or at least some of the things they're saying to Socrates, will be expressions of their beliefs. But one of the things I want to say is, it's an advantage, and not an easily replicable advantage, of the way in which Plato writes these dialogues, that we don't get just their beliefs. We get full, very sophisticated portrayals of beliefs as one of many expressions of character, what it's like to be that human being. So when Socrates comes out and says there's a contradiction here, it's not merely a claim about certain propositions being contradictory or inconsistent. It's a point about something being hollow at the heart of these dispositions, the heart of these practices. There's a problem in the culture. And the contradiction between these propositions is one way in which philosophers can get at the problems in the dispositions, the problems in the wider culture. So that's my claim about Socrates. This is based on a paper where I do all the things I'm not doing here, which is lots of chapter and verse, careful disagreements with other interpreters of Plato and so forth. But I thought this might be not where the right audience to prosecute little local exegetical disagreements about 155b of the Theaetetus and how to read the second sense of being. I'm relying here on people recognizing something like this picture of Socratic practice and also this alternative description of it that I'm trying to give. Now, here's a series of analogies that I think will make a little bit better sense of what's going on in some of these dialogues. And the slightly revisionary view of Socratic psychology that I want to propose here. Now, there's one, and I'm going to use this word perhaps ill-advisedly, there's one very Cartesian way in which some people read what Socrates says. The idea is something like, these people appear, get in a conversation with Socrates, and they've got these things, beliefs, and these beliefs are sort of little things in their minds, and when Socrates asks them a question, they sort of look around in their mind, sort of pull out a belief and say, here's my belief. And the idea is, Socrates has to ask them these questions because it's got to do with this, with the privacy of the mental. How else can you get at someone's beliefs until they express them to you in conversation? But one thing I want to say is, making good all the different elements of this psychological picture will go beyond what I'm going to try and do here, but what I want to do is just set out this alternative non-Cartesian picture of what might be going on here. I want to say that it's not so much that there are these things, pre-existing beliefs, they're also already there, like little packages in the dark room that is their minds, and that they're sort of bringing out when Socrates demands that they do so. It's rather, it's much more like this. The kinds of questions Socrates asks them are questions about things that are kind of implicit in their thought, their practice, their discourse, right? So when he says, what is courage? It's not this kind of weird technical terminology. It's not defined the day dicta. He's saying, here's this word that you, young Athenian man, who's probably fought in some wars and fighting some more, here's a word that you use all the time. Define it for me, please. And there's something simultaneously innocent about this question. I mean, of course you should be able to define courage. I mean, you use it all the time. You use a word all the time. Maybe you even possess the disposition yourself. So how can it be an unreasonable thing to ask you to define it? But of course, as it always turns out, things are always harder to define than they seem. Even these perfectly innocent words that we think we know the meanings of turn out to be rather harder to define once someone like Socrates comes along and says, well, if you think that, what about the usual kinds of Socratic objections that come to any putative definition in these dialogues? So here's my alternative proposal. It's not so much that these interlocutors get into conversation with Socrates with fully formed beliefs. It's rather that the beliefs are being formed precisely as responses to the Socratic provocation. So what's going on here isn't introspection. It isn't, what is courage? Let me think. I'm going to root around my mind and find this belief I have about courage. It's rather, it's the old Gareth Evans point, someone says, do you think it's raining? You know, so say, what do I think about whether it's raining? You look out the window and see if it's raining. And there's all sorts of great deal more to be said about what's going on here, and very complex debates in the epistemology of mind that have to do with making sense of exactly what Gareth Evans is trying to say at this point. But I think what Socrates is doing isn't just close your eyes or lean back in your armchair. I don't know if they had armchairs in ancient Athens, or the relevant equivalent, and tell me your beliefs. It's rather, here's a demand for you, a deliberative demand. Think about this question. I know you haven't really thought about it before, even though you unreflectively go on saying this stuff. You say courage, you say justice, you say beauty. But think about what they really are. So the idea is that this is an opportunity for someone to go back and try and form a belief. And it turns out, so one thing that I'm using this as evidence for is this claim I've made at various points on my handout, is the idea that common sense, as something that's shared among lots of people, but also as something that is possessed by any particular individual. Common sense is something I have, you have, or indeed lack, if you do enough years of philosophy. So if common sense is something you can have or lack, then by looking to this alternative interpretation of giving what Socrates is asking, One thing that you might conclude from this is that actually common sense isn't this fixed body of beliefs. It's rather that it's a whole bunch of psychological phenomena, using the loosest possible terminology here, the stuff going on in the mind, and the content of whatever it is in the mind will underdetermine any particular attempt to give it precise propositional articulation. Right? So there's many different ways of interpreting the kinds of phenomena that go on in our minds, and some of them will often be captured in the kinds of things we say in philosophical context. It would be wrong to push someone off a bridge to stop a speeding train. It is obligatory for you to pull the lever and make the trolley change tracks. It's rather that in thinking about these kinds of examples, what we're being invited to do is to reflect in a certain way about the question itself. And we're forming a certain belief in the course of doing so. And the methodological challenge for us is, are we doing this well, or are we doing it badly? So I'll end with a couple of analogies, and I hope that they'll use a basis for a discussion and some defense of my views from various potential objections to it. So the first one I want to say is in the following context. So lots of people are rather unsettled by what Socrates does. They think, you know, he's just put these words in their mouth, he's just got them to panic and blurt out these things they don't really think. And I want to say, well, once you get away from this thought that there's something that they really think, and point that, and accept that it's being made up by those interlocutors in the course of dialogue anyway, there's a different analogy, a different way we have of thinking about what Socrates is doing. So it's not so much that he isn't paying attention to kind of the way in which they're rather gingerly, reluctantly, confusedly saying things. It's rather that it's important for him that he ignores their reluctance. Right? In the same way that if you're playing a chess game with someone, a move is a move. The same way that a claim in these kinds of conversations is a claim. And if you say something in these kinds of conversations, you don't, in the same way that in the game of chess, it would be like, well, you moved your knight really reluctantly there, so I'm not going to take your queen. Because you clearly, they really seem committed to that. No, you've made the move. And in the terms of this game, a move is a move. Now, what I'm suggesting is that the kind of, dare I say, language game that the Socratic method or Socratic practice is involves something like this. It's getting someone to make a move in a certain kind of language game. And by treating that move as exactly the same kind of move, no matter how reluctantly, confusedly, etc., it was made, one of the things he's trying to do is exactly the same thing, two analogies here, if you were a chess tutor, on the one hand, or just, say, a supervisor at Cambridge. Of course we know that many of the things that students say in supervision aren't things they really, really believe. It's not like there are pre-existing beliefs about the viability, the limits of materialism that they bring with them into the tutorial. It's rather that in goading them and taking absolutely seriously what they say, no matter how kind of half-formed, confused, etc., one of the things they're trying to do is to bring about a certain kind of psychological evolution or development. You say, here's what it is to take your views, your beliefs, your practices seriously. Here's what it is to take responsibility for them. And in the same way, in the game of chess, the way in which you learn is by being merciless. Someone makes a move, you take that queen if it was a sloppy move. And the same in certain kinds of philosophical contexts as well. One way in which you grow up, become more adult, as a philosopher, as a thinker, as a reflecting individual, is precisely by doing this, by creating contexts where there's a kind of urgency and the need for responsibility that's involved in, for instance, a game of chess. So a final thought, and I'll stop there. This is on questions of style in philosophy, how we write philosophy. One of the things I've been trying to suggest here is that it's to tell against or urge against this temptation to think that we come into philosophy with these fully formed views about, you know, the reality of the external world, the possibility of knowledge, or, you know, the rightness of pushing or not pushing people off bridges. Really what's going on, or rather I think how we ought to think about what we're doing when we're doing that kind of philosophy, is as invitations to certain kind of potentially open-ended reflection. So we're trying to get ourselves to think about what it would be to take responsibility for our views. So what's the upshot for this general kind of moral philosophical project? The short answer is something like this. Along the aspiration of the kind of moral philosophy of which Ross and Sidgwick are exemplars, is that what you end up with in this kind of philosophy is a theory. The theory is a bunch of propositions. What I want to say is, here's this other way of thinking about it, where the end point isn't a theory. It's a certain kind of reflective, thoughtful, sensitive, perceptive person. And if you think that that's what we're looking for, right, then the aspirations of philosophy and the kind of conception of common sense they adopt as starting points won't be just a bunch of propositions in order to get to another bunch of propositions. It'll be some reflection on what it's like to be a person, what it's like to feel, think, act in certain ways, as ways of trying to make ourselves better, more perceptive, more sensitive. Right, I'll stop there.